recent years, neoadjuvant chemoradiation has been increasingly utilized to manage patients with rectal cancer, and I met with surgical oncologist Dr. Stephen Wexner to obtain a surgical perspective on the disease. To begin, Dr. Wexner commented on his initial evaluation of the patient.
Firstly, I'd like to see the colonoscopy report from the gastroenterologist or the referring colorectal surgeon to know that there's no synchronous lesions. Excluding synchronous lesions or assuming the other lesions were adenomas removed, we have a single rectal carcinoma. The next question to ask is, how close is it to the sphincters? Will we be able to do sphincter-saving surgery? And what stage is the lesion? Towards that end, the most important exam is the good old-fashioned rectal exam. How far is the tumor from the dentate line? Is it exophytic? Is it ulcerated? Is it fixed? Is it tethered? Anterior versus posterior can make a big difference, both in males because of the difficulty getting under the prostate for a distal dissection, and in females because of the possibility of needing a posterior vaginectomy or even an en bloc, more radical resection in females. Posterior has the luxury of a little more space to work with the mesorectum, but in an advanced tumor, again, could be an exoneration, in an extreme case, a posterior exoneration. So the first thing is the position of the tumor. What's the tumor like? One can get a very good idea just on that basis. This one feels soft, freely movable, probably T1 to T2, probably amenable to surgery without any pre-op XRT and chemo, and in some isolated circumstances may be amenable to a transanal excision or transanal endoscopic microsurgery in very limited circumstances. The other test then is visualization of the lesion with either rigid procto or far more commonly, obviously, flexible sigmoidoscopy. But for the very distal lesions, flexig won't really get a great look at them. You're really better to do it by feel as a surgeon. Quantify how many centimeters to the dentate line. That's key. Is there sphincter involvement or not? For the higher lesions, mid-rectum and certainly upper rectum, obviously, then visualization with flexible sigmoidoscopy is the other step. Once that's done, the next step in algorithm is the ultrasound, which I do immediately. Same day, I send it to one of my associates in my practice. I don't do colonoscopy or the diagnostic testing, but everyone else does. So I send them off, and within an hour or two, they come back, and I know, is it T3 and or N1, in which case, obviously, they're going to get referred for chemotherapy and radiotherapy. If it's T1 or T2, it's a different discussion with the patient. So that's the initial part of staging. Now, you can supplement that depending upon the patient. CAT scan, for example, might be useful. A PET scan might be useful. Those are a little bit less important in the immediate decision-making process, but certainly are important down the line as you decide upon the surgical therapy.
What have you observed in terms of the impact of chemoradiation neoadjuvantly in terms of how it affects the tumor and your ability to do surgery?
The efficacy and the safety of the chemotherapeutic agents and the method and modality of delivery of radiotherapy has so vastly improved over the last two decades that we've gone from fearing it pre-op because of not wanting to give extreme skin damage, terrible radiation proctitis, make the tissue planes difficult to handle, increase morbidity of perineal wound healing. We've gone from that extreme to the extreme that in most cases, I can't tell by looking that the patients had pre-op chemo RT, except at the site of the tumor, which in one-third of my patients is gone and left with but a scar. So it's gotten dramatically better. It's also made surgery easier because these large bulky tumors that seemingly used to get more fixed and more fibrotic with the treatment now are going the other extreme. They're disappearing. The tissue planes are getting a little bit edematous, and it's facilitating dissection in most cases.
Is it changing the procedure that you're doing?
I don't think it's changing the procedure in most cases. There are those few isolated cases where the tumor is in that distal third, and you obviously don't change the position of the tumor, but because you're shrinking the tumor, you may enhance the resectability in a curative sense. So I don't think you can really convert from an abdominoperineal resection to a coloanal. But I think you can take cases where coloanal would have not been oncologically curative because of a big tumor and pushing it around to a case where a coloanal is oncologically curative with a good distal margin.
I think kind of the standard for neoadjuvant therapy has been to put a pump in a patient, have continuous infusion 5-FU with the radiation. Are your oncologists using or trying out capecitabine instead of that, which is oral, you don't need the pump?
Yeah, you know, one of the advantages of working in a tertiary referral center like the Cleveland Clinic is that patients are coming from such a wide geographic area, and the type of medicine practiced is very varied, from university practice to community in the Caribbean or Central America and community in the Southeast rural U.S. So, yeah, I see a bit of everything. And I think that I wouldn't want to render an opinion as to whether or not it's better, but it's certainly being used.
I was just curious, when the patients come back to you, do you see a big difference in their quality of life or what they say to you about the experience comparing taking capecitabine to IV-5-FU with a pump?
Clearly, it's advantageous for quality of life, not having the pump, and the safety profile speaks for itself. But again, I don't have any particular scientific data. The anecdotal reports are that patients are continuing to work and they're not being bothered by interrupting their schedules and they're not spending as much time fussing with the ports and things.
You mentioned transanal excision. How do you approach that decision? How do you approach it technically? And are you involved with the American College of Surgeons study looking at that?
In terms of the decision for transanal excision, there's been a lot of back and forth in the literature where transanal excision was initially thought not to be a great procedure. Then it went through a period in the 80s and early to mid-90s where it was used extensively. And now we've gone back over the last 10 years to see very high recurrence rates. And not only high recurrence rates, but when patients recur after transanal excision, the lesions are often incurable at that point. These patients are getting palliative resections. So the use of it is limited, in my view. You have to have a very special situation. A T1 lesion, I would not approach a T2. It's got to be a T1 lesion. The most common scenario is either someone who's fairly unfit for a major operation, even laparoscopic, or someone in whom the major operation would require an abdominal perineal excision just because of the location of the T1 lesion, right on top of the sphincters, and you're not going to get a good margin, but you know it's only T1. And the patient is young, and they say, I'm willing to take that risk. I'll be followed along. And then there's this whole question, should you give them either pre- or post-op chemoradiotherapy, which is, of course, one of the trials underway. There's no answer to that question that I know of yet. That's a special group of patients, and that has to be a very long and very involved discussion because I don't believe that operation is as curative. I think its far better role is in the elderly, infirm patient with a T1 lesion where you're willing to accept that little bit higher recurrence rate in lieu of the higher morbidity rate of an abdominal procedure. The transanal procedures, these days I'm preferring by the transanal endoscopic microsurgery. I think it's a more exacting technique. I sent one of my junior faculty to be trained by Buse in Germany, and I preferentially send her cases, unless they're in the very lowest part of the rectum. Anything in the mid-rectum, I think it's better approached under direct visualization with finesse. It's like anything else, and I'm sure the results will ultimately be better because the tissues are being handled more precisely and more carefully with the transanal endoscopic microsurgery approach.
Can you talk a little bit about laparoscopic surgery?
Laparoscopy... Well, I began doing it in February of 1991, I believe, so 15 and a half years ago. And we started doing cancers, and then there was this spate in the literature of these port site recurrences, as well as inadequate margins and other issues. And we really put everything in check for a while. We put together a prospective randomized trial in the U.S. Heidi Nelson was the principal investigator for that study, to look at the equivalence of laparoscopy for colon cancer. And during the approximately 10 years that the study was underway, we were only operating on cancers within that protocol, at least curative operation. Palliative was a different issue, and we continued to hone our skills with all of the benign diseases, rectal prolapse, diverticulitis, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, endoscopic, the unresectable polyps, Hartmann's closures, lysis of adhesions, ventral hernias, all the other aspects, but just leaving colon off on the side. And then ultimately, once the trial finished and concluded, as did the two counterpart trials, the classic trial in the UK and the color trial in Europe, that it is equivalent, and it may potentially even be better. Tony Lacey in Barcelona, Spain, shows for stage 3 patients, they do better laparoscopically. They have less recurrence and better cancer-specific survival, perhaps due to less immune suppression. So it's at least equivalent, possibly better for colon. And ever since that trial was published about 2 years ago, it has become, I believe, the preferred approach in most practices. Certainly in my practice, it's the preferred approach for colon cancer.
What's your take in terms of the morbidity doing the procedure laparoscopically versus not?
There's an interesting meta-analysis. There's a couple of them, but the one by Chapman, there's two, Chapman and Abraham are, I think, the best that are out in the literature. And the most recent iteration of those data show that there is less morbidity with the laparoscopic approach in a number of ways, wound infections amongst them, ileus being another one, as well as the usual things of less pain and shorter hospital stay, but actually a lower morbidity laparoscopically.
What have you observed in your own practice in that regard?
A lot less problems with things like incisional hernias later on, a lot less problems with wound healing later on, particularly in somebody who's gotten chemotherapy or going to get chemotherapy. I think one sort of unmeasured variable at the moment is when you can start chemotherapy postoperatively. In a patient who's had a laparotomy, you may need to wait 2 months till that patient is stronger, their albumin and prealbumin are back up, their blood counts are stable, they're feeling stronger, the wound is healed. In the laparoscopic group, you may be able to easily do that within a month because these people have already been back at work, back at the gym, back active, you know, eating their regular diet. They've put on whatever weight they lost at surgery. And I think that may be an unquantified benefit of laparoscopy. We're finding when we're successful laparoscopically, it's not universal, which is why it took a long time for the technology to really be accepted. But in most patients, the recovery is quicker. And patients are moving around quicker. They're feeling better quicker than with the open counterpart.
I've heard surgeons question whether or not they can kind of get an adequate evaluation of the abdomen to see the liver, et cetera. People who maybe went through training before this sort of started who have skepticism about the oncologic role or value of laparoscopic surgery versus open.
Well, I went through training before laparoscopy existed, so I certainly had those same sentiments. But once you get used to using the laparoscope, you find that you can do not only as good an exploration, but probably better in certain areas. The magnification is a big advantage. Splenic flexure is seen like you've never seen it. The pelvis is seen beautifully. Any potential enlargement, abnormal enlargement of a lymph node would be staring at you on a big flat screen monitor. The only possible area, as you say, is the liver, but if someone is so inclined and they don't want to rely on their pre-op CAT scan and PET scan, they certainly can do intraoperative laparoscopic ultrasonography. And that's a very readily available technology, which after a fairly reasonably short learning curve can be almost universally applied if one has that concern.
What about laparoscopic surgery for rectal cancer?
Rectal cancer is a different area. Really, the sacral promontory is a great divide between the tail of two cancers. And in the colon, there's never an issue getting a lateral margin. There's never an issue getting a distal or proximal margin. It is what it is. The lateral margin is the walls of the colon because the colon is free. Maybe certain retroperitoneal tumors could invade in that direction. But basically, the lateral margin is defined by the wall of the colon. Distal and proximal are never an issue. Once you've divided the blood vessels, the whole colon devascularizes in that segment, and you're going to take wide margins. Even healing isn't as much of an issue. When you do an ileocolic resection for right-sided cancer, ileum has great blood supply, middle colic vessels are intact. Rectum has a lot of different issues, the biggest of which traditionally was margins, because you've got a bony pelvis on the side, the sacrum in the back, the pubic bone in the front, plus prostate and vesicles in a male or a vagina in a female, and a large uterus. So enter a large tumor in a small space, and it can be technically difficult to get around it. The tumor may be inappropriately handled, even inadvertently inappropriately handled, with tumor shedding despite irrigation and tapes and all the rest of it. So the oncologic opportunities are not the same. In addition, you may have radiated that tissue preoperatively, unlike colon, which doesn't get preoperatively radiated. So you have to worry a little bit more about the blood supply as you're doing an anastomosis. The issues are different. Laparoscopy for rectal cancer has several huge advantages, one of which is the magnification. You get a great view of the nerves, of the vesicles, presacral vessels, everything you could possibly want to see beautifully. But it also has a disadvantage because the current iteration of instruments doesn't really allow us to work down and around corners under the pubis, under the vesicles, under the vagina. And in some distal tumors, I'm not convinced we can get as good an oncologic resection. In some, we absolutely can. But in others, heavy set male with a narrow pelvis and a large prostate, I don't think at present we can do that. So you have to be very careful with rectal cancers.
What have you observed in terms of morbidity of the procedure?
definitely less. I think colon, especially in a thin patient, you can get a laparotomy done in an incision not much bigger usually than you'd need for laparoscopy. So there's a gain. But rectum is a whole different kettle of fish. It's a big gain for the patient in terms of morbidity, in terms of pain and recovery time, provided we're oncologically sound. And we seem to be, but we haven't done the U.S. study yet.
So the study that's going to be done, who's going to do it?
It'll basically be the same group of surgeons from the COST study.
It's going to be randomized?
Yes.
You're going to be part of that?
Yes.
Do you feel comfortable randomizing patients in that situation with your own experience?
You know, it's always an ethical question if you think something is better, but it hasn't been proven better. And again, I had two new patients, say, with rectal cancer, and they both asked the same question, well, what do you think I should do? I mean, patients with a rectal cancer don't come with a preset notion. And if I tell them, as I did today, well, I don't know that one's better than the other. One has a little bit better recovery, but probably will be a longer operation. And the other one will be a much quicker operation, but may have a longer recovery. But oncologically, we don't know if there's a difference. I don't think that'd be hard to enroll patients in the trial. It's not something that clearly is hands down better. If I knew that the recurrence rate laparoscopically was half what it is by laparotomy, that'd be an easy one. But we're not in that setting.
Right now in your practice, roughly what fraction of the rectal surgery is done laparoscopically?
The majority. It'll vary month to month, but the overwhelming majority would be laparoscopic or laparoscopic assisted.
What about the decision in terms of sphincter preservation? How often do you see patients who are coming in for a second opinion who've been told they're not going to be able to have their sphincter spared and you tell them they do and do it?
Often. Or often patients come because they're told, if you want your sphincter spared, you'd better go to this place and see Steve Wexner at Cleveland Clinic. Otherwise, some patients do come later on with a recurrence or for some other reason, peristomal hernia, and you look at the path report and there is an 8-centimeter margin to the dentate line, but they had an abdominal parenchymal excision. It can happen. I think most surgeons are aware of what should and shouldn't be subject or who should and shouldn't be subject to an extirpation of the sphincters. The issue is if they're comfortable doing it. I mean, how many people are comfortable doing a coloanal to the dentate line in a patient who's been irradiated? That's an individual decision. But I think one has to be honest with the patients and say, yes, this can be done, but not by me, or it can be done by me, and my local recurrence rate over the last 5 years is X. It's 3%, it's 13%, it's 23%, whatever it happens to be, and level with the patient.
My perception as an outsider looking at the field or talking to people these last few years is that it seems like perhaps there are a lot of people who are not having their sphincters spared across the country who maybe could if they were going to a tertiary center. I don't know if that's been quantified.
I don't know either. The best data that probably exists on that is from the American Board of Surgery. Wallace Ritchie followed up an original earlier publication from the American Board of Surgery from, I think, Ward Griffin. But the Wallace Ritchie publication, which is maybe 5 to 6 years old at this point, looked at surgeons sitting for recertification, general surgeons, of which there are about 25,000 in the U.S. And the average general surgeon at that point was doing 0.8 rectal cases per year. Well, at 0.8 cases per year, that's not a huge volume. And interestingly, even when you look at all the studies on outcome dependent on volume, whether it's Porter's study from Canada or whether it's Holmdahl's study from Sweden or Simmons from California or any of the studies through New York, through Maryland, Pennsylvania, a lot of database studies have been done. Most surgeons are doing just a case or two or three per year at most, even in these studies. And even in some of the studies, the so-called high volumes, maybe 5 to 10 cancers in a year, which is not a high volume. I mean, my department this year, if you annualize what we've done year to date, we're looking at over 150 rectal cancers this year. Very different volumes and, you know, obviously potentially different outcomes. But what hasn't been quantified is how many of those patients with distal third lesions. You figure overall there's 45,000 rectal cancers, give or take, new rectal cancers in the year. They're not necessarily in equal thirds, and probably half of those are in the distal third of the rectum, and the other half are distributed in the middle and upper two-thirds. So say it's just a guess, 20 to 25,000 lower third cancers. Nobody's said how many of those people get an abdominal parenchymal excision. I don't know that there is a way to know. There probably is, but I don't know it.
What about bowel function and quality of life in these patients, particularly patients with the low lesions?
Reconstruction is as important as the removal. When I talk to patients, I tell them our number one aim is to cure the cancer. Our number two aim is to restore continence. It has to be a quality of life, because if you do a straight coloanal and then, let's say, add insult to injury by radiating a straight coloanal, the patient's going to be miserable. They're better with a colostomy. They absolutely, honestly are. There was just a study, I believe it was last month, from Finland, disease of the colon rectum, looking at quality of life of colostomy versus a standard anterior section. And at least in Finland, patients seem to have a better quality of life with the stoma, which was a surprise and different than what you might think intuitively. The way that we've managed to best improve life is making a neorectal reservoir with a colonic J-pouch, taking what we've been doing for ulcerative colitis with ileal J-pouches. In around 1985 or 6, two different French surgeons, Lazaros on the one hand and Parkin Tourette on the other, described this colonic J-pouch. And it was kind of variably used over the next couple of years. And then in the early 90s, combined with three centers in Sweden, we did about a 100-patient prospective randomized trial between straight coloanal and colonic J-pouch. And the colonic J-pouch patients had markedly, statistically significantly better function, less bowel frequency, less urgency, less incontinence, better quality of life with the J-pouch. Bunch of other studies since then, Francis Souchon from Singapore and others. And that has, I think, become the standard. So that is the best quality of life to most closely approximate post-op function to pre-cancer diagnosis function with a good, compliant, capacious rectal reservoir with a J-pouch. There's been some other techniques tried, for example, coloplasty, but that seems to have a very high leak rate. Colonic J-pouch, I think, remains the standard.
I'm not sure how some of these studies evaluated quality of life, but I guess one thing I'd be interested in is how often patients who've had their sphincters spared actually come back and want to have a stoma put in. They're unhappy with that decision.
It's pretty rare.
I mean, I've heard that people are willing to tolerate an awful lot in order to avoid a stoma.
Well, that's why the Finnish study was so surprising.
And I mean, did they ask the patients that?
I don't believe they asked that specific question. I think it was more like an SF-36 instrument.
So they're just measuring a bunch of things but not saying, what would you have preferred?
Well, exactly. I don't believe that question was there. That's an excellent question. And it's one I always ask my ileal J-pouch patients with colitis if they come in and, you know, move my bowels 8 times a day or 9 times a day or whatever, and I take some Flagyl once in a while for pouchitis. Well, were you better when you had your temporary loop ileostomy? Oh, no, absolutely not. And I think that question you ask is an excellent one, and it really is the best parameter to ask the patient directly, which, again, I think is why it's important to divert these patients, because if these patients ever need stoma, they shouldn't be afraid of it. They should know what it's like, and it should be well constructed. Now, the difference, of course, it's an ileostomy instead of a colostomy, but at least they're used to having a stoma for some period of time. They can make an intelligent decision. Very, very, very few of them will ever go back to a stoma, and that's a good point you make.
What are your thoughts about number of nodes obtained and how often they're an inadequate number and what the cause usually is?
It's a very interesting question. Colon and rectum have to be segregated. Rectum is almost an easier one to answer. With all the neoadjuvant chemo and XRT we're now using, very often there are few nodes found, and I think it's because they're genuinely sterilized. Colon is somewhat of a different issue, and if you look by the Japanese standard of trying to find 20 nodes in these patients, the reason they're generally not found is twofold. Either the surgeon didn't remove enough or the pathologist didn't look hard enough. There are techniques like xylene fat clearing and others where you can certainly find lots of extra nodes, regardless of what technique you use. But it is twofold. It's not just technique of the surgeon. It's technique of the pathologist as well. Ideally, I'd like to see that I've got at least 20 nodes in my colon cancer cases and in my non-radiated rectal cancer cases.
When it is a technical issue with the surgery, what's actually happening?
Usually it's not a high ligation and it's not a wide resection. So instead of taking the ileocolic vessel, the surgeon's taken the right colic, and therefore your node ligation isn't near the SMA, but it's after the takeoff of the right colic, and all of the higher nodes are left behind. Or for rectal cancer, somebody's divided the superior rectal rather than the inferior mesenteric above the left colic, and all those nodes are left behind. I think that's the biggest technical issue, is just not doing a high enough ligation. It's interesting. The other problem that usually goes with that, the patients who I reoperate on for anastomotic leaks, a lot of people get sent in because they've had a leak. Inevitably, they didn't have a high ligation because the IMA and IMV are still intact. They didn't have splenic flexure mobilization. It's the universal finding in these patients with anastomotic leaks. So it's easy to understand if I'm seeing it for anastomotic leaks, most patients don't get leaks. They heal. But presumably most patients are getting that same operation. And therefore, you're only getting the nodes between the sacral promontory and the rectum. That's it. That's not going to be 20 nodes. In colon, it's the same thing. You find if you reoperate, it's less common to have a local recurrence of a right colon. But generally, you find the entire ileocolic arcade still intact and somebody just took the right colic.
What about the patient who presents with a primary colon cancer or metastatic disease to the liver?
It depends what the nature is of the metastatic disease. Is it unilobar, bilobar, how many mets? You have to make a decision as to resectability or not. And then you've got to have a discussion with the patient as to timing as well. Is it a synchronous resection? Is it a metachronous resection?
Let's take both scenarios. First, a patient who's got bilateral disease in the liver and they're not going to be resectable.
Then you have to decide whether or not you're going to do any surgery at all for the primary lesion, because if you're saying that the surgery would only be palliative, are you going to do it? Which means you've got to look at what's the reason for surgery. So if it's an obstruction from rectal cancer, that's probably a patient you just want to stent. But if it's significant bleeding from a sigmoid tumor, you may want to do a resection. If it's a patient with a bad cardiac history and persistent anemia from a cecal cancer, you may want to do a laparoscopic right, knowing you're not going to touch the liver. But again, that's another good example to do minimally invasive and have a very small incision. So if you get post-op ascites, you're going to have less chance of a big wound, dehiscence, and evisceration. On the other hand, take a patient who you say the liver mets are resectable, then the question is timing of what you're going to do. And that, again, is going to depend on the availability to surgeons of a good expert liver surgeon with them. If it's somebody who can do a quick liver resection with acceptable blood loss, there's no reason you couldn't do it as a synchronous procedure. On the other hand, if you don't have a surgical team comfortable with livers or doing high-volume liver, it's probably in the patient's best interest to deal with the primary disease and then, as a metachronous procedure, if you will, have the liver dealt with.
You were mentioning the issue of surgery or radiofrequency ablation for liver metastasis. What have you observed over the last 10 or 15 years in terms of the oncologists will say, we have much better chemotherapy now, we can shrink these things down, we should be much more aggressive. I'm always curious about what people outside the oncologic field feel about that. Do you see a difference in that in terms of the efficacy of chemotherapy and the ability to deal with these patients?
Yes, definitely. I think the chemotherapy is better for liver too. I'm not as firmly convinced that there are as many complete responses as I read about, but certainly the partial responses are there. And the armamentarium to deal with the partial responses is more. It's not just systemic chemo versus hepatic artery chemo. It's radiofrequency ablation. It's cryo. It's laparoscopic, which again, if you're going to do a laparoscopic cryo, that's a whole lot less morbid than the old-fashioned big chevron incision to get at the liver. And in a patient with potentially limited life expectancy, that's a good thing. For a patient who's set up for a right lower lobe pneumonia, that's a wonderful thing that they're going to be able to get out of bed and walk rather than having a big subcostal incision. So the availability of the laparoscope, again, plus cryo, plus radiofrequency, and even certain laparoscopic resections of the liver are available. I'm not a liver surgeon, but certainly as president of SAGES, I see lots of laparoscopic procedures from other disciplines, and they're impressive what could be done laparoscopically in the liver. Whether laparoscopic or open, the consistent outcomes for liver surgery seem better, at least again in higher volume centers. The expected mortality from liver surgery for metastatic disease, the expected morbidity, the expected transfusion rate, all of these things are far better than they were 10 years ago.
How do you approach the decision about whether to refer a patient with colon cancer to a medical oncologist for evaluation for adjuvant chemotherapy? And I'm particularly interested in stage 2 patients.
Anybody who's got a full thickness tumor is going to get referred. And I tell them, you've got to have an individualized discussion with your medical oncologist and your family. And I would advise you speak to some patients who have had chemo and see what they think of the experience. I think patient-to-patient communication is critical. When I deal with my patients with ulcerative colitis, albeit a different disease, they're coming in to have a J-pouch, the first thing I say is, what year were you born? And they tell me, and I say, fine. I'm going to look at my database of the last 500 J-pouches, and I'm going to pick 5 people of your gender, plus minus 10 years of your age, and I want you to talk to them. Because I can tell you everything, but you need to hear from them. Chemo's like that too, because just like taking out a rectum and making a new one out of ileum, giving somebody a year of chemotherapy is a life-altering experience. And it's an optional one. You can't argue, I suppose. about taking out the cancer. This has to be done. Assume there's no liver mets, there's no lung mets. You can take out the cancer. So they can get information or not, but it doesn't change the fact that they need the cancer removed. Chemo, particularly for full-thickness node-negative disease, is optional, like J-pouch for colitis perhaps. So patients really should be given the opportunity to hear from other patients, what's the experience, what are the pluses, what are the minuses. So I tell them, I'm not going to make the decision for you. The decision I'm making is that you may benefit, but you've got to look at that risk-benefit ratio with the medical oncologist, with other patients, with your family.
It's interesting because I kind of saw that evolve in breast cancer starting in the late 80s. In terms of the use of particularly chemotherapy for node-negative breast cancer, where I saw the surgeons getting more and more interested and referring more and more patients. And nowadays, everybody with invasive breast cancer goes and talks to a medical oncologist. I'm not sure that happens with stage 2 colon cancer as much.
But I think it should.
I think so, too.
I think that full-thickness group is one who is at high risk. I think that nobody's disputing the node-positive patients. And nobody is disputing, at least nobody I know of, that the ones confined to the mucosa are not going to be referred.
Sure.
But that middle group has some potential benefit.
Well, you know, it's interesting because people talk about the breast cancer patient as willing to go through chemotherapy for a relatively modest improvement in outcome. And we found that really nobody had done surveys of colon cancer patients to see what their attitudes. And we did that last year. And that was the ASCO GI abstract that we presented this year, where we surveyed 150 people with colon cancer. And they actually listened to a 45-minute audio where, I don't know if you know John Marshall from Georgetown, he went through the risks and benefits and toxicities of chemotherapy. And afterwards, we asked, you know, granted, these people may be a little bit different, but they were a random segment of people with colorectal cancer. And we said to them, based on what you heard, if you had a loved one in their 60s in good health who had a stage 2 colon cancer, what would you suggest or recommend that they receive it? And 149 out of 150 said yes. Which was, I mean, maybe it's not quite that high, but the point was, it was that same attitude of being willing to go through a lot for a slight improvement in the chance of remaining recurrence-free.
But I think the reason people are willing to accept that now is because the toxicity profile is so much better than it was 10 to 20 years ago. People would have said absolutely not. Now, first thing I tell my patients is this is not the kind of chemo that's going to make your hair fall out and just give you crippling diarrhea every day of the week. And, you know, you do still have your outliers who end up with neutropenia or whatever, and you've got to discontinue or modify. But the vast majority of these people, literally and figuratively, don't turn a hair, and they do very well with it.
What are your thoughts about virtual colonoscopy?
I think virtual colonoscopy is probably the best way to get a lot of those extra people screened who don't want to have something 1.6 meters long put up their backsides to look around the colon when they say, nobody in my family's ever had cancer. Why would I want that done? Well, because you can have sporadic mutations, obviously. Virtual is an easier one for people to tolerate. The problem is, of course, it's not being paid for except in case of incomplete colonoscopy. So if we ever got to the point that the technology was inexpensive enough and the payers felt that it was worth preventing cancers, to me that would be a very, very good option. If you're doing virtual colonoscopy, you need to have real colonoscopy spaces available the same day. Because as a service, what you don't want to do is have the patient come in, like a screening mammogram program, and then tell them 3 days later, oh, by the way, this was found on the screening mammo. Now you need to come in for some further imaging with ultrasound, with whatever, make another trip, figure it out. Now they're worried all the time in between. You want to go from virtual colonoscopy, because unlike the mammogram, not only is it inconvenient time-wise, they got a bowel prep as well. So now you're going to take a second bowel prep, which has its own inherent potential problems, plus the time off and worry and come back. So as a service, what we do at the clinic, and I know what many others do, is leave some spots available in the colonoscopy schedule. And I would encourage the surgeons, if their radiologists are offering virtual colonoscopy, to make sure the radiologists know that you as a general surgeon or colorectal surgeon doing screening colonoscopy will keep some time available. And if your patient goes and there's a finding on that study, send the patient over, and that day you say, either I've removed it, or I've biopsied it, or I've found out that it was a false positive on virtual colonoscopy.
What do we know about false positive and false negatives with virtual colonoscopy?
I don't think we know enough yet is the problem. I don't think we know enough yet. We're still in the learning curve, and the CT technology keeps improving. You know, we've gone from 32-slice scanners to 64-slice scanners, and now we're looking at 128-slice scanners, and I'm sure 256 aren't far behind. And every time there's new software, the radiologists have to go back up their learning curve on the equipment. And since it's not being paid for, there aren't enough done, except in the few centers publishing about it. But that's not the real world. The average guy practicing in a hospital somewhere probably doesn't have a radiologist with enough skill set and patient base to really be expert at it yet.